Stefan, thanks for coming on today. Greatly appreciate it. I'm pumped to get into the details of this talk today.
No, it's good. It's been obviously I've called it off a few times for various issues, but it's nice to be on here, man. I've listened to your stuff for a long time, and obviously we spoke a while back, and yeah, massive respect for what you do.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. And like you say, we've been trying to get this in the diary for a while, and I'm glad we've got it in.
Yeah.
Why don't you, just the one or two people maybe around the world that maybe don't know kind of what you've been doing and the phenomenal information you've been putting out, just give us a quick intro, a quick rundown of kind of who you are and what you've been doing.
Yeah, cool. So I'm currently director of sport at a private school in the southwest of England at Somerset, called Wellington School. I'm an ex-professional sportsman, so I played two sports, rugby and cricket, but cricket for about 20 years. Not that it matters. I'm an ex-pro. It's a big bugbear of mine, actually. Just because you're a pro doesn't mean you're going to be a good coach. But then I came out of the game. I wanted to learn more about myself, so I wanted to experience coaching different levels. I could have stayed in the game, but I came out. And now I own Pace Lab Limited, which coaches fast bowlers around the world, but it's slowly going into baseball as well, which is great. That's where I actually see my future. And I coach various fast bowlers and with the Rajasthan Royals. So I was at the IPL last year. This year, I'm more of a development coach and coach them throughout the year, because I've obviously got my school gig here and responsibility. So yeah, it's busy, but it's always learning, always reading the likes of yourself and various coaches around the world. So it's I'm in a good place.
Yeah, I mean, like incredibly busy, obviously. And then, like you
Yeah.
say, lots going on. So you mentioned obviously fast bowling there. That's kind of your thing, as well as maybe getting into some of the baseball world. Why don't we just get into that straight away, get into the thick of it. So what do you see as like the common traits of a fast bowler? And just for maybe some of the
Cool.
international audience that are listening, just explain kind of what fast bowling maybe is.
Cool. So I'll share my screen. Have you got that?
Yep. Yeah, we're good to go, mate.
So, firstly, I sort of that's what purpose for me is coaching. My aim is to develop the robust fast bowler. Okay, and I adhere to the dynamic systems principle really. So it is very much Bosch's work and various, and I think that is the future. So is to create the best mechanical outcome in a highly unstable and unpredictable environment. My big thing with lots of sport, it's we develop robotic athletes because it's built in a gym, and that lacks a transfer of training because it's nowhere near specific enough in terms of the kinematics of it, and the speeds of it. So I'm seen as the guy who is a bit maverick, but I train myself, and I'm a firm believer in my stuff works because of the specificity of it. Like I said, I'm very much guided by Franz Bosch, really. I know he has his critics, but it's complicated. It was complicated, but now I'm able to put it into context, and I can see it. And I can see, when I watched him first and about the attractor well, and I'm going, what on earth is this? But actually, when you put it all together and make it specific to your sport, it just makes sense. And it's so that he does the layering model of specificity. So everything starts with an intention. You've got to make the brain give a damn. So it's everything I do has an intention. And it's especially as I work with different level athletes, really, from your 10-year-old girl bowling to someone like a Jofra Archer or a Ben Stokes or a Varun Aaron who bowl 90 miles per hour above. So, a big thing like so, this all movement must start with an end goal. So, this is a great picture of one of my bowlers at school here. He loved Brett Lee, who's the fastest bowler in the world at the time. And look at that, that is exactly the same. And I didn't coach that. His brain had an intention, and we found a way of his body found a way of self-organizing and getting to that intention that he had. So the dynamic systems, in sort of very simple and quick rundown, we're a complex system, or actually a complex biological system. And I'm big on the biotensegrity model. Fascia, I think we missed the point in training. We don't respect fascia lines, and especially something as coordinative as fast bowling. It is all about fascia. It's not about muscle. The skill happens too quickly for it to be about muscle. Your muscle are the protectors, the stabilizers, but actually the skill itself with the speed and the forces, it's about fascia. Fast bowling is reflexive. I'll get to exactly what fast bowling is in a minute, but we're self-organizing. The type of feedback we give is key. Intention action model, big thing are the attractors and fluctuators, and the variability in training is a big thing. Giving it an intention and then taking the slack of the system. Fast bowling happens too quick, like I said, for it to be about the stretch shortening cycle. We need to take the slack out of the system and pre-tense before impact, before the action itself. And this is where the skill stability came from, really. Mm-hmm. What the best do? So that was the question, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So this is what happens in fast bowling. So fast bowling is like a javelin throw. It's like a pitching, but with a run-up. So you run up speed. So I split into three zones, the approach, the impact, and the delivery zone. So the run-up speed, in simple terms, the faster you run in, the faster you bowl. How do I know that? Because I have a 1080 sprint. You know, how do I know the forces on back foot, front foot, an impulse strike? Because I have four steps. You know, so I've tested everything here at school with a couple of my guys here, and we know that if a guy runs in or a girl runs in quicker, ball velocity increases. So there's a huge correlation between the force on front foot contact and ball velocity. So the more force you put in, the higher the impulse on the front foot contact, the higher the potential to bowl quicker. But there's so much to it that took me down this rabbit hole, really, because you look at different bowlers and they look different in terms of their size. They run in differently. And that takes me to my hip and knee dominance, which I'll cover in a minute. So the forces are massive, but the big thing is you haven't got time to impart those forces through muscle. You just, you know, what is it? Stretch shortening cycle is 0.5, 0.25 for a fast stretch shortening cycle. Actually, fast bowling happens quicker than that. You know, you're on your back foot for 0.10 seconds. So it's not about muscle. It's about tendons. It's about fascia. And it then takes you to how can you train that? But then what is so unique about fast bowling is all those forces. You know, I know run-up speed is more of a tempo running, actually 7 to 8 meters per second. But you do that 6 balls in a row with 20 seconds rest, and you've got to do that for about 20 times a day. So that's 120 of those balls you have to bowl in a day. And I tell you what, because it's stressful, we're going to make you do it the next day again. And actually, you might even do it the day after. So that's what makes cricket fast bowling so unique. It's that the forces involved are more than anything. You know, when you sprint, it's 3 to 5 times your body weight. But actually, when you bowl, front foot contact is up to about 10 times your body weight of force. So strength is important, but you haven't got time to impart that strength you have. So that's why strength has a point of diminishing returns. And that's a big thing about my training. Is the ultimate question is, what I'm about to do with that guy, is it going to transfer? Is it going to help him brace his front leg or her front leg and help them bowl quicker? So fast bowling is aerobic, elastic. And I do believe, like yourself, and you know that's why I love your stuff, aerobic fitness is huge in sport. It really is massive, but because it's been pushed aside, because a lot of trainers now just go down the lactic route because they like to see someone sick on the side because it's a sign of working hard. Aerobic training has lost its importance in the program, but for me, it's number one. I, you know, I'm big on Triphasic, Carl Dietz. I love his stuff. Matt Van Dyke, I love their stuff. And they always start a block with aerobic, you know, the long extreme ISOs and that sort of stuff. It's, yeah, that's where my training is. So rotational speeds are massive, but it's actually, rotational speeds don't differ for a lot of bowlers. They're quite high and the arm speed are the similar, but actually it's the timing of it. So that's that proximal sequencing, one of the attractors that we have in fast bowling. So this is what I found out that I've studied.
Just before you go on there, Stefan, do you mind just saying, just for the listeners that maybe aren't sure, just quickly just say kind of develop like what a tractor is and the body system, and then a fluctuator as well, just so people understand kind of what we're talking about here.
Okay, so it's about developing a large bandwidth of movement, but not too wide and not too narrow. So degrees of freedom is what the body can adapt to in a variable environment. So there's a lot of variability when you bowl. You know, you might be sore, fatigued, the batter, you know, you might be a gun player, or you might be not very good. So it's lots of variability involved, the foot holes. So no two delivery you'll bowl will ever be the same. And then, so you need that ability, your degrees of freedom to adapt to the environment. And then you've got the degree, so they're the fluctuators, and you need enough of them. And then you've got the degrees of constraints, then the attractors, they need to be the fixed, they need to be the fixed hard skills, you could call them that every fast bowler has. And they need whatever the bowling action looks like, whatever the age, whatever the biomotor qualities, the attractors need to be hit for you to know that actually technique is not the limiting factor. So like I say there, it's about the best bowlers have developed a technique that gives them optimum protection. This involves fluctuators to adapt to environmental and anthropometrical constraints and biomotor qualities that provide the correct stabilizing effect of attractors. So it's not a case of fluctuators are not important. They are important because they stabilize the attractors and let them do their work. And if you look at a bowler, the best bowlers have the same attractors. So it's not about building robots. It's about building athletes, athletic fast bowlers who hit keynotes exactly the same way. So those are the attractors. And what are they for a fast bowler? So for a fast bowler, they would be these, okay? So I split them into intramuscular and intermuscular attractors, and it's very much Franz Bosch. And so the intramuscular is the importance of the abdominals, the importance of stability around the pelvic area, the importance of the rotator cuff for throwing. They will help then the intermuscular, so how the muscles, how key parts of the action interact with each other. And like I said, it's about identifying which ones, which parts of the actions, which intramuscular and which intermuscular attractors need to be fixed and limited the degrees of freedom. Bowling is very much reflexive. So like I said at the start, bowling is a reflexive skill. You know, you can't consciously, the only thing you can consciously think of when you're bowling is bringing the ball up. I firmly believe that. That's the only conscious node in fast bowling. Everything past that point is reflexive, whether it's stumble reflex or a crossed extensor reflex. And it's the body is a protective organism. It wants to inhibit everything. It wants safety. It wants to go back to safety. You know, we were born in flexion and we will die in flexion. So the body will always want to go into this parasympathetic state of flexion. But fast bowling and tennis, like you, doesn't work in flexion state. You need extension. So everything, all the attractors that I've found for fast bowling are the ones that get you into extension. So whether that's hip lock, swing leg retraction, extended force closure, plant from above, braced front leg, ankle stiffness, that activates the crossed extensor reflex.
So what was the, sorry to interrupt you there, but what's the kind of process going through your head at this point to help you? If other people, if coaches watching this being like, okay, so these attractors are obviously very important to sport.
Yeah.
And every sport, every movement has key attractors.
Yeah.
So what's the process that you go through in your head to be able to identify? If you were to give kind of a bit of kind of a menu or something like that, an instruction manual to say, okay, well, this is how you identify key attractors in sport. Like, what goes through your head when you're doing that?
Okay, so first thing you need to do is look at the bowlers, but I've already done the work for coaches. So if you were looking at other sports, you want to have a look at what they do, what the top performers keep repeating. And then, because attractors increase performance, but also stabilize and avoid injury, they're injury protectors as well. So the classification of attractors, okay, there are infinite ways to bowl the action, and you never ever want the same bowling action. That's why, you know, you can't fit an individual into a bowling type, because everyone's different. Like, everyone in India wants to bowl like Brett Lee, but Brett Lee bowls like Brett Lee because he is Brett Lee. Mm-hmm. But trying to get that concept out, it is difficult. But what they do, what Brett Lee, what Shoaib Akhtar, what Jofra Archer, what Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad, these guys have, they have the same attractors. So you have three types of attractors. You have active attractors, which they enhance performance and they protect against injuries. You have active emergency attractors. A lot of bowlers have them, but they don't help performance. And then you've got passive attractors. They reduce performance and don't protect against injuries. But a lot of bowlers have them, so that's why they're called attractors. So how I would look at it, what the best do and what do they always hit? So I know now, okay, that the fastest bowlers run in quicker. The fastest bowlers brace their front leg. The fastest bowlers maintain the momentum from back leg into front foot contact. The fastest bowlers hit the contralateral extension, which is where both arms are parallel to the floor. So even though we're a biotensegrity model, actually we need to create tension and compression, which then would help the mechanical model, and then levers and fulcrums and pivot points become important. But actually, it's the understanding that we're not fixed points. It's fascia around the muscles need tension and compression, which will then allow the bowling action to be more efficient and effective. So those are the attractors that those big guys, the Varanaran there, they hit. Okay, and then you go about training it. How can you then train that? So for example, so different sports have different attractors as well. So like for, Jonathan Edwards here now. So the first stride, when he hits that board, that's a crossed extensor reflex because he's got horizontal momentum. So it's not that much force. But then the second and third stride, there's so much force because of the gravity and the height he's jumping at, the body gets into protection mode then. Mm-hmm. That's when it becomes a stumble reflex. So that's why some bowlers who jump too high get into a world of trouble, because coaches tell them to jump, turn sideways, because they activate the stumble reflex, which is not a performance enhancer, it's an inhibitor, it's a protective, where a reflex that's a crossed extensor reflex is a performance enhancer. That's when it's a hard, stiff contact, which takes me back to isometrics, okay? So it's all links together. And that would be an emergency attractor for fast bowling. Mm-hmm. But stumble reflex is an active attractor for a triple jump and a long jumper, because it increases performance and it protects against injuries. So it sounds really complicated, but it isn't. And let me just say now, so these are the, so the abdominals they're the highest priority, and I've only realised that this year, actually. They're the highest priority for any training, is to maintain the length, the optimum length for the abdominals. Everything else doesn't matter. They're the connectors between the arms and the legs. And the thing with attractors is there's a bit in the middle where you go from one attractor to the other, like respect the sagittal plane. So going forward, you don't want to be going into the transverse plane, because then soon as your back rounds, you switch off the abdominals because of that inhibitory effect of once flexion in the back, you turn off the front, what's it called again? The inhibition, really. Mm-hmm. So that is why it's really important that you understand all this in training. That the abdominal...
Is it that kind of understanding that's led you to, I suppose, understand more? You said kind of the abdominals only the last year or so is really kind of
in front of your thinking.
It's that understanding. What was your kind of line of thought beforehand? Because I'm sure there's a lot of coaches in that boat.
Yeah, it's just looking. So firstly, it's about reading. So just pick, and there's so much information out there now, and there's some intelligent guys out there, you know, with Kofis, Fichter, the Altis guys, Stuart McMillan, James Smith, Thibodeau, yourself, Kieran and Flat. These guys are top draw, man. So it's about listening to some of them and making it relevant to you. So obviously Franz Bosch, I'm heavily influenced by Franz Bosch. Just pick what's relevant to you, respect the other bits, but don't confuse it. Really, I know the system looks confusing, but it's not actually. You look at a bowl, so you study bowlers, you find out what they do, what their critical indicators are of running it faster, bracing the front leg, contralateral extension, flexing up the waist, heel contact, that stuff. And then you understand why they can't hit them. So why can't they hit those KPIs? So you test them. Is the limiting factor technical? Is it a limiting factor motor learning? Is it hardware or software flaw? Is it biomotor qualities? Are they really weak? That's why, you know, the 1080 and the force decks are really important for me. And then when I look at a bowler and they can't brace the front leg, and then you go, why can't you do that? Is it because then you don't hit the attractors? Is it because when you go off the impulse stride into back foot contact, you try and jump too high, which then creates the stumble reflex? We know with the stumble reflex, it's a hard landing, so it goes into a protective mechanism, and the front leg will come down quickly. So you have a small delivery stride. Small delivery stride, you'll have a collapsed front leg because it can't cope with all that mass over it. So it all links up, and then that's where skill stability comes in, then, isn't it? When you go, okay, he can't do that. Mm-hmm. Let's limit the degrees of freedom. And let's fix that position. So if I just go quickly, so the hip block is one of them.
Yep.
That's a great exercise for hip block. So all the exercises. So the great thing about, I follow, you know, Bondarchuk, I follow him a lot. You know that. Vukochansky, these guys, Yesis, is my stuff is different because it's a blend of S&C and technical. It's mixing it together. James Smith's governing dynamics of coaching. You need the knowledge and everything to truly make a difference. Nothing exists in isolation. Mm-hmm. So I blended it together because I'm qualified S&C. And then obviously I played, not that that's important. And I coach, I know how the brain works, know about motor engrams and the pattern, and, you know, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. I can create change by understanding how the brain works. So it's hip block, swing leg retraction. You look at bowlers, they have swing leg retraction. They, by extending that front leg out, creates tension, pre-tension, which then will always brace the front leg. You'll never be able to brace the front leg, which is a massive attractor, which is the main one, okay, if you don't swing leg to retraction, which if you don't brace before you hit, you'll never brace after you hit. And that is a massive thing that coaches miss out on. And that's specific to anything. You know, baseball, I know baseball is a flex and extend because they need to create more momentum. But javelin and fast bowling, you know, needs brace front leg. And you can see how you know you got swing leg retraction is when that pullback, see that claw back there? Mm-hmm. That's why Jofra Archer bowls so quickly, is actually on delivery, he's higher than where he was on front foot contact. It's increased by about half a foot. That's why for those who have seen Jofra Archer bowl, he hits a lot in the head. Because
does that allow him to come over more?
And obviously, it's a catapult.
So
he lands and he pulls himself forward. Uh-huh. So it's about how fast, how much momentum you maintain in the center of mass into front foot contact. That's the key. Mm-hmm. That's the number one indicator. And he does that better than anyone, you know.
And you're looking to create stability through that front foot contact, so then we can transfer through the system and then catapult the ball towards the target.
Exactly. And to do that, you need swing leg retraction or extended force closure. So pelvis, okay, this is, and I'll be honest with you, you only learned this year, so people will be seeing this for the first time. This, you need tension around the glutes. Mm-hmm. You need tension around your pelvis. And to do that, you either need swing leg retraction where that front leg comes up, extends forward, creates tension in the glutes and that four bar system, so the quads, rec fem, and the hamstring. So it's tense, it's locked, and then goes into front foot contact with tension, pre-tension, core contractions. Some can't do that because they're side-on bowlers. They're side-on bowlers. So then they can, because the pelvis has limited range of movement. With that limited range, you need tension, but you don't want too big a range because it can't cope with that. So somewhere will have to go somewhere, and normally you find mobility somewhere either up the system or down in the system. So the lumbar region becomes stressed or the knee capsule becomes stressed because it searches for efficiency. So that's why you need either, which is this one, it's a great example. So my guy there in the middle was massively rotated on the backs on rear side. So he's got tension there. So he can't now get tension on the other side because it can't cope with that. That's too much tension. So he will collapse that front leg, but he sends it forward. And that's why he can brace his front leg. So you'll find that bowlers who are overly side on rear side will never brace their front leg. And then the other side is the front arm bowler, hip dominant bowler, and I'll cover that in a minute, needs some tension on the front side. So that's why by crossing over slightly creates enough tension to brace the front leg. So that's extended force closure. And I was looking at a bowler recently for Australia who's front on and lands down that train track that I've talked about and a lot of people talk about for alignment, but actually that doesn't create enough tension. That doesn't hit the attractor extended force closure and he collapses his front leg. People will know what I'm talking about. So his coach needs to just create that tension by bringing that swing leg retraction over a bit.
So he's got, essentially what you're saying is, just for those people that maybe don't understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, essentially he's just got energy leaks going on, so he's not got that fast
transfer. No tension.
Yeah.
So there's no tension. There's no tension or compression, which that fascia needs to stay locked, and the muscle needs core contraction. It's like a straitjacket. Core contractions are like straitjackets on key points of the bowling action. So these are other attractors, but we maybe can do a whole webinar or whatever on attractors of throwing, man. So there is, so those they are, and then you've got the proximal sequencing of a baseball thrower there. So this, it always start with the hips. So I was under the impression it started from the floor, which is why I did pre-turn drills, but actually it starts from the hips, then goes to the knee, then goes to the floor. But the pre-turn exercises that I do where you turn in that back foot are really important, but they actually start with the hip. Again, I only knew that this year, really. But sometimes the attractors get into competition and conflict with each other. That's when I was talking about earlier, you can't be side on the back and side on at the front. Mm-hmm. You will never be able to brace your front leg. So they're conflicts where they, and it's the hierarchical system where the one attractor will always dominate the other attractor, which will cause failure. So it's there's a gang leader. There we go. A muscle with a dominant attractor is seen as the gang leader, and the other followers in the pattern of movement. To change technique, the gang leader needs to be changed first.
Why don't you just quickly touch on like hip on knee dominance? Because I know that's very important. And how you identify that, just for people that maybe don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's so I'm seen as different in that hip and knee classification and the skill stability. So hip and knee is how you're wired. Mm-hmm. It's how they land on back foot and they angle on the back knee. It really is that simple. But there's a reason for that. And I believe it to be down to fascial lines. And it's how they're built, how they're wired, how they grow up, you know. In India, for example, so a hip dominant bowler has a small angle, okay, about 20 degrees or whatever, it on back knee. And then a knee dominant bowler has more flexion.
Do you have an example of that?
So there is the great example. So so the one on the right there, so that is Varun Aaron, so that's a hip dominant bowler. So it doesn't have knee flexion, doesn't require rotation. So it's not about side on or front on. It's about the fact that they don't need to access the longer stretch shortening cycle. They don't need movement because it's all tendon. It's all tendon driven. So they are thin, they're wiry, they are your Frankie Fredericks, they're your Usain Bolts, they're your Jofra Archers. I had a boy who weighed 54 kilograms. I don't think I was born that weight. And bowled 85 miles per hour.
Wow.
Okay. And then I had another guy who was short, stocky. There he is there at the bottom right, but relied massively on proximal sequencing, hip internal rotation, trunk rotation, and was quite strong. He relied on stretch shortening cycle, which is why hurdle jumps, force-driven jumps were really key for him. Whereas my hip dominant guy, which is the second one over here, if I had them jumping on soft surfaces, his calf would be screaming. Because of the added time, then it would shift the load onto his muscles and his gastroxyleus couldn't cope with it. Mm-hmm. So that is, whereas the guy, the knee dominant guy, just hated hard surfaces. He wanted time because it just happened so quickly. So knee dominant guys are muscle driven. Then you got hip dominant guys are tendon fascia driven. They look different. They bowl different. And the key is then for coaches to look at them and identify firstly. So those are the three determining questions down below. Yep. You modify, you change the bowling technique to utilize the increased time. So that's why I believe the five fastest bowlers in the world have been slingers. Right. So for those who know cricket, Shoaib Akhtar, Sean Tate, Malinga, Jeff Thompson, Fidel Edwards, Mitchell Johnson, because they used their strength and the ability to access the stretch shortening cycle with their technique. It matched up. So biomechanics matched up anthropometry. So they needed strength. Bench press, squats. To be fair, knee dominant, you'll never get a knee dominant training program wrong. It's not that hard. If you get that wrong, you're in a bit of strife. You're probably in the wrong profession. But the tough one is hip dominant. They're your athletic, tendon, fascia, thin. You look at them and go, you're going to snap. But actually, they never snap.
Do you think they're the guys that coaches, if you don't fully understand the difference in kind of maybe training? Them. Yeah, so they're the guys that, if you don't understand it, you can just completely ruin their career.
Destroy them, because you try and make them do what everyone else does. You go, mate, you've got to squat two times your body weight, surely. How can you bowl to go from 88 miles per hour to 90, you need to squat two times your body weight. And you go, actually, I can only do 70 kilograms at the minute, but I'm bowling 88, so it's not going to work. And I've seen them so many times on my career. And they're also your neurotypes. They're your type 1B neurotype, which we'll cover in a minute. So you just need to know what you're doing with these bowlers, man, in all sports, actually. It gets in baseball as well. So your hip-dominant guys in baseball are the ones who start the movement with the center of mass going forward, whereas your knee-dominant, muscle-driven guys actually have that. They sink. They sit on back foot contact to create time, mm-hmm. to access that power, that stored energy, whereas hip-dominant guys haven't got that. So they need to get momentum. They need to shift center of mass over to the front foot contact, because in baseball and fast bowling, it's about the direction of force on front foot contact, which is the key determinant of fast bowling and throwing, pitching. Mm-hmm. So brace front leg is really important. So if I take you to the skill stability, shall I do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get into that. I know we're kind of tight on time, but let's get into the skill stability paradigm. Just explain kind of, if anyone's never heard of it, do you mind just giving us a quick rundown? And obviously, so this is essentially how you develop your bowlers, your athletes.
Yeah, definitely. So I started doing it about 5 years ago, holding a position. So I thought to change technique, hold position. And I've always trained. I've always been isometric guy. I've always done it. Thibodeau got me doing it 20 years ago, I think. So I thought, how can I do that into technique? And then identifying the tractors. So I thought, well, why not hold your tractors? Why not hold, limit the degrees of freedom, simple organism, and fix the positions? So there's 7 ways to create change. Stabilize your tractors. Skill stability ticks that. I've identified back foot contact being really important. I've identified the impulse stride being really important, which is the stride before, and I've identified front foot contact and the delivery. So there's 4 key nodes in the fast bowling action that need to be able to hit the attractors. So why not get rid of anything else, train them differently, the sprint and technique, and focus on those hitting the key positions. So how you do that, you manipulate time, you create the feel, feed the mistake, overload the movement, change the goal, add variability. So that's how to create change, because it taps into your subconscious mind and you develop a new motor engram, new pattern. The problem starts when you do technical work like walkthroughs or slow drills in sprinting. It's too close to what you've done a lot of times for it to have a change. For you to change technique, you need to take your brain to a totally different place. I don't mind doing like sprint drills or bowling walkthroughs, it's called, with a weighted implement or exigent suit to create overload, because I'm ticking one of the 7 ways to create change. So that's when it started.
Sorry, Stefan, just that last bit there. Does that then come down to the like reticular activating system, is it, if I've got that right? And you've got to be able to overload that?
Yeah, it is. So it's like the on button in your brain. Mm-hmm. So the RAS is the on button. It's like the gate to motor learning. And it needs novelty. It needs to be stimulated. You need to entertain me. You need to give me something different. Because I've done gazillions of this bowling action before. And I'm not going to open for you. It works like that. I'm not going to help you learn. I'm bored. So and this slide actually is a great place to stop. It's to avoid sensorial adaptation, which means you've used to bowling the same way, doing the same repetition. You need to have variability in your training. And those are the 5 ways. Complex training, I'm massive on that. Same but different. So that would be skill stability, exigent wearable resistance, fatigue-induced learning, and randomness chaos. That's how you create variability in training. Complex variations, So again, you know, I do Bondarchuk and Derek Avely. So if to create change in complex training is perfect, because so for me, I would do an incline press. Okay, I would do an incline bench, and I would superset that with either a skill stability, front foot contact, or weighted ball bowling. And the smaller you keep that transfer window, the more chance it has of going into the system. Your body still thinks it's doing the heightened awareness of the central nervous system enhances the ability to learn that technique. So it's complex training is important. So this is the same but different. This girl opens the bowling for him. Oh, she's gone. But she held the position and then did overhead throw. So it's the same base position, but actually it's a diff. So same base position, but she's throwing a medicine ball. So that was same but different.
So you're still doing technical that.
Work on lower body, but actually her one intention is, her one conscious cue is throwing that ball as hard as she can. Her subconscious coach is grooving the pattern of the brain of that base there. That's why my stuff works. And there's a bowler in South Africa now, plays for South Africa Test cricket. He's only been doing still stability for 2 weeks. He's now bracing his front leg. I'm not a magician, but it's just understanding how the brain works. That is as simple as that. Wearable resistance. Exogen is awesome. It's specific, but you can do it either performance-wise or developmental-wise by changing technique, by putting the weight of the loads in key positions. So this is a great example here. So he's wearing a suit there. How you load them up will create change. So he's in bowling, you know, wearing a full suit. So he's overloaded, and I know that's one of the seven ways to create change. Fatigue, I know you asked me earlier about that. I'm a massive fan of fatigue-induced learning. I think it asks questions of your mind, your body, the muscle fatigue, the contractile element forces the body to formulate greater contribution from the fascia, from the tendons, which we know is what happens in bowling.
So let's just get into that.
Tempo bowling.
Just if we get into that for a second. I know you're going to get into the tempo bowling, but I just want to clear up for some of the listeners. By fatigue, we don't mean like lactic bath, you know?
No.
That's the thing lactic. We do not mean.
Lactic doesn't come into my train, and lactic is the enemy of speed. It's just a totally different chemical reaction of the body that we need to stay away from if you want to increase the pace of bowling. You need to be fresh. You need to be avoid of any lactic acid. So I know I do Tony Holler and the Feed the Cat stuff. You know, that's, you know, they get them. I get them to bowl as fast as they can into a wall, free of constraints of direction. You've just got to bowl as fast as you can into the wall. Then you'll have 3 minutes rest. Mm-hmm. And then I want you to do that again as fast as you can. Your only cue is max intent. I'm not worried about technique. But then when we get them to, and then initially motor learning, you don't need fatigue. The initial stages, you need to be fresh. But then when you get to stage four of skill stability, I introduce fatigue. So that's when the process is really important. So skill stability is my technical model. So there are four key nodes, like I said, impulse, back foot, front foot, delivery. So it's about fixing those. It's about like that car analogy of fixing the front wheels or the back wheels and fixing the degrees and limiting the degrees of freedom, because there's infinite ways to bowl a cricket ball. And if we're changing technique, we need to keep it simple. But that's why the exercise itself needs to be complex. So it's very much from Alex Natera, is sprint specific, run specific, isometrics. But the base of it, I do vestibular work. I'll show you a video here now, where you create tension, a part of front of your body will activate the flexors. If you create isometric tension on the back, it will activate the posterior muscles. So I'll show you now. So the first bit, the base of it is yielding isometric, which I call, and Alex calls the iso holds, but I put them at the base. So that is more, that's longer extreme isometrics, holding positions, and then you move on to overcoming.
Which how long are you going in that position for? Like, is that the kind of 3 to 5 minute duration?
Yeah, that's the three. Once they can hit 3 to 5 with either the loads or time under tension or variability, mm-hmm. that's when we move on. So that's it there. In Natera sort of terminologies,
yeah.
I start with a static stage, which are the iso holds. Then we go into iso pushes. So there's no movement there. So we're just grooving a pattern. This is technical work. And it's about, it's not going to transfer into your bowling straight away until you put some movement into it. So, and then... dynamic stage is the next progression. Everyone, there's 4 stages of learning. Everyone goes through them differently, but the key is for your subconscious to be your coach. The dynamic stage, isodynamic, so there's movement involved, concentric, eccentric. It's just to create a stability, structural integrity around those key nodes. Now we had an eccentric component to it. And a big thing with eccentric training has to be specific as well, because the ground contact time in bowling is so small. Even your depth jumps 10 times your body weight are not specific enough. The only true exercise for fast bowling is fast bowling itself, mm-hmm. either done quicker or with a load. That is the true transfer of training. Everything else is supplementary, but finally, ending at that point, like assisted bowling on the 1080 sprint with the exogen suit on, that's the number one. When I have fast bowlers using that training method, I know ball velocity is a guarantee. I know that they've gone through all those stages. And yes, they're generally strong. They can body weight, they can press and all that malarkey, which I don't, that's a given for me. That's athletic development. That's not fast bowling. But Stefan, you don't do any strength work. Yes, I do. But I don't shout about it because that's a given, surely.
Yeah.
We all know.
I think that's where people kind of misunderstand some of your training as well, is they say, and I think it's important to actually get this out there. They think, oh, maybe Stefan just does this all kind of very specific carryover competition exercise, et cetera, and doesn't hit the base of the pyramid. But you do that, but you just don't post about it, because that's the stuff that everyone does.
Yeah, that's a given. That's general strength. That's GPE, you know, and trap bar deadlift and incline press external rotation and pull-ups. They're in all my programs. Someone trained with me, they'll go, blinking heck, that's intense. But it is. But you'll always bowl in my sessions, or you'll always do a skill stability. If you walk into my sessions, you go, there's a fast bowler. Whereas my issue is they'll walk into a gym somewhere in the world and they go, a bodybuilder, as a CrossFit athlete, great athletes, but I'm training sportsmen or sportswomen. You know, it's about skill, it's about coordination. So a big thing for me recently is the vestibular system, and it's the number one system for me, and it doesn't get trained a lot. So it's the system that makes you aware of where you are in space and which way is up. So the bowler there, obviously, how on earth does he know where he is, you know? And it's, so I introduced it to my skill stability model, and here it is. So here's the first, this is the first stage of my skill stability. So the bottom of that tier. So I'm putting tension in the front. I'm putting, like, I'm not sure you can see that. So if you push forward, then the isometrics or the VCI isometrics, prior to back foot, that creates a better ability to hold flexion in your knee, and then we lean back, activates the posterior chain, and then I do that before front foot contact. And then you've got the eye gaze, the VORs, the vestibular ocular reflex. So I track, so So I hold the front foot contact. So that is a delivery position, but I'm fixing my gaze. I'm fixing my head and looking around. And then you have the infinity walks, back foot contact, pulsing. So this is a big thing. I've not shown this to anyone before. So your listeners and people watching this would think, what the heck is going on there? So they're infinity walks done specifically for my skill stability work.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So, okay. So this is the impulse stride. Give me 10 minutes.
Okay. There you go.
This is the exercises I would do for the impulse stride. So we have the flywheel there, overloading that key position that we get into when we bowl. So it's, you know, it's this, that stride there. Okay. So yep. That is the impulse stride, which you can see that happens, swing leg retraction on that cheetah below as well. So that is, we've just got to copy. There we go. There's swing leg retraction. We got to copy what the animal kingdom do, man. Because he's pretty quick, that fella. And then, so you find a way of overloading it. So this exercise here would be an iso hold. Holding a position for 30 seconds. Then this one here then would be for hip power. So then you see these before, and we're using force decks as well to measure the force output, the impulse rate, the force development on that impulse stride. You'd obviously then make it more specific using G strength there. So he's pulling up, so a hip, the force produced in that position, which is specific to the impulse stride. Then you add specificity into it. Then you got the tantrums. Then still maintaining posture of that pelvis. And then we go into ankle stiffness. So this would be the back foot contact and the spring ankle series by Corfist. So we want a 4 foot rocker on back foot, and we want a heel rocker on front foot contact. So those are isometric series that I would do. And these are to the back foot position. So this one on the left here is stage two. So that's an iso push, overcoming.
There we go.
Midway. East side on bowler. So he's going through three different positions of them.
Push.
So he's pushing above against that wall.
Push.
So no. We know 10% more muscle fibers are activated, which makes isometric a great training technique.
Push.
But then I always superset an isometric with a dynamic component for it to be transferable.
Go forward.
Just for the listeners, why do you think that's important?
What? To get a dynamic component?
Yeah, so you've obviously gone ISO, like you said, increased motor unit recruitment, and then we need to put it into action for the transfer. Yeah, like, why do you think that creates the transfer?
Because it's more specific. So that the heightened effect of the isometric will create the subsequent action more effective, and also that transfer window needs to be small. So the smaller we can keep that window, then you go on to the dynamic correspondence and the transfer of training and that sort of conversation then. But I think by doing, which is why I do the full tier in a session, if you're going to do isometrics, you need a dynamic component to it. There's no point doing an isometric session. Even if it's, I do 5 sets of a front foot contact hold and I finish with a bowl.
Yeah.
Like, I do 6 balls of bowling at the end. Just the last thing your brain needs to remember to increase the chances of it becoming truly a direct positive transfer needs to be the skill itself.
And the, so I don't know if this is right, but the way I think of it is, if I do my ISOs or whatever movement, I want to finish on something fast as well, because you don't leave like a stain, so to speak, on the nerves.
Yeah, definitely. And that's Schmidl-Breiker principle, isn't it? Your brain will always remember the last thing you do. That's why if you want to change technique, you should not be in a competition. You should change technique away from competition, because whether you like it or not, you're going to revert to type in competition with the stresses and you won't be able to change technique. So if I go the left back foot contact, they're all isometrics, and there I've got EMS on the calves as well to increase the recruitment of the calf muscles. Then we've got iso. Put up iso switch there, put as much force into the floor. That is Alex Natera. And then these shock training, bringing a dynamic eccentric element to it. So bang, brace that front leg. Band is pushing him forward. He's off the bench. So that is big. And then the guys at Driveline used it as well. Mm-hmm. Up top right here. So they used the exercise. And I think his name is Drew. And they created it. They love the fact, because internal rotation is not trained massively in baseball, apparently. So they saw it and they liked it. So this is what I was on about, the preterm pulses.
Yep.
So the hip turns right. First.
Good, and come back.
It's a proximal sequencing. So that is for a side-on bowler working eccentrically and concentrically. And you actually, because she's knee-dominant, side-on, muscle-driven bowler, she needs to train the muscle. So we've overloaded with exogen suit there. Yep. And if I show you front foot contact, so front foot contact is actually a different, I have a different focus. Back foot contact is about stiffness. Front foot contact is about extensibility. There's a difference because you're spending more time to increase the impulse on front foot contact. It's actually about 0.5 seconds. So then it's about actually the combination of flexibility and the force. So this is where iso holds become a big thing and longer duration isometrics. Back foot contact is overcoming short blasts, max intent, push, relax, push, relax. Whereas front foot contact is more about holding it and yielding under the forces and the stress.
Being able to kind of resist and overcome and produce that
definite,
force. Yeah,
definitely. So those are front. So if I show you here now, so this is time. Aqua bag above the head activates the paraspinal muscles, which are your ready muscles in your trunk. And then a simple organism, complex environment. So if because the drill itself is simple, you need to create variability with the drills itself.
Go sideways it with it. In different positions. Separation. Nice.
The aqua bag's there, obviously, with water and the Bernstein's theory. Or variability, no rep will be the same. So this is a great example of extensibility. That's a heavyweight there, but heavyweight holding the isometric position of a front foot contact. He would hold that now. And if you can hold that, if you can tolerate about 1.2% times your body weight on that load, I know there's no reason why you shouldn't be holding brace front foot contact. Here's another one. This guy, both South Africa, has a good amount of weight on there, of 100 kilograms, and he's holding that position. He's doing an isometric cluster. Hold it, relax, and then go again. Hold again in that position. This one over here is a partial overload, but he's holding that. He's holding that front foot contact position. So this is the skill stability. So it's about isolating the key attractors that I'm looking for, bracing the front leg. There we go, pushing back. There's a more concentric element to it. And then we've got the iso catch, which is the last stage. So this 1080 sprint, pulling them forward, bracing that force, you know. Then we've got altitude drop there.
Yeah, perfect.
In that position.
So this is your final method of overloading the system?
Sorry?
This is the final kind of method that you use to overload the system, that fourth stage?
If they can do this, so if they can do a 1080 assisted and an altitude drop with a weighted vest, and depending on what we're working on, some bowlers may need more back foot, some already brace the front leg, and I just need to stabilize it. So every bowler is different, no one size fits all. But I know if they can brace an iso catch, you know, I know there's no reason why they shouldn't brace their front leg on front foot contact. Mm-hmm. And this is because I believe that front foot contact is more about muscle, then it's about grooving that pattern.
Yep.
That's an exercise I came up with. It's, you can do it with aqua bags. You can do it with anything. So swing leg retraction, hip lock.
Just to clear this up, just for kind of a lot of the listeners, and I think I'm right here. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not, as you go into that front foot contact and you're bracing. There's a good example on the left here. You're not actually, some people would think you're hyperextending that leg, but there's a slight bend in it where you're loading the quads and everything else.
Here's one for you, is that when you're doing this, that's why it's a great cue. When you're doing these drills, if your bowler or if your athlete, javelin throw, actually braces when there's static, I know that they don't brace their front leg when there's momentum into it. They're only bracing now because the joint, the ligaments, because, and they will be hyperextended because there's no force there. They're static. But actually, I want them to have a slight flexion and create tension by tensing those muscles. Like, you know, here is what, it's 120 kilograms on there. So I'm doing a front foot contact. See, iso, that's an iso push, but it's an iso blast. So pushing, that's a short, sharp isometric, which would happen in fast bowling itself. But you see, I'm slightly flexed, then going into extension. Never hyperextend. If your bowler hyperextends, you know that they lack stability, they lack the muscular development and the structure around the knee to cope with the forces. Then you got the delivery position. Eight. Same thing.
Six.
Overcoming isos, pushing against the wall, and then supersetting that with flywheel overhead. And then he will then go into one of my favorite exercises that I came up with, with the oscillatory bands overhead. So it's that reciprocal inhibition where you have to relax. The best athletes in the world are the ones who relax. So they're the ones who tense, co-contract, pre-impact, and they're ones who are able to relax quickly on action. And that's what separates them.
And I think that's something that's massively overlooked in sports performance as well. And I know that Carl Dietz puts a lot of different videos out with these kind of banded oscillations and things like that. And we do it into our kind of, I suppose, peak and phase, if you want to call it that, for our tennis players in that overhead position and the oscillation. I just think it's very important.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So I can finish on this if you want me to. So this would be reflexive trimetric method, because with the skill stability on back foot contact and front foot contact, it's very knee and ankle dominant. Mm-hmm. The hips don't get that overloaded. So this is a great method to overload hip extension and the power in the hip, because we know on impulse stride, the more power you maintain from impulse into back foot, into front foot contact, the faster you bowl. That is the key to it. Fast bowling is sprinting, it's not jumping, and it's about maintaining as much momentum, as much of the running velocity, which should be between 7 and 8 meters per second, into front foot contact. And on contact, having the capacity to stabilize, avoid deformation, and utilize that energy. Here's one for you. Isometric positions again, but with the shoulder sphere on the upper body. That is an awesome exercise, and it's so hard, man. But I know, okay, if they go through the process. So this is the last one. This is the isoreactive.
Nice, and rest.
That's my bowler are ready. They're ready. They're ready to perform in a highly reactive and stressful skill. There's nothing like it, fast bowling. Mm-hmm. Nothing
and
like it.
I think
it.
just for the listeners or the viewers that are watching this, because I know that some of the videos may be kind of jumping a little bit just on my end, but just as a quick explanation, essentially what Stefan's done with his athletes here is just kind of banded them up, and we're moving through a very small range of motion. And it's essentially just oscillating around that joint angle, tapping into that kind of reciprocal inhibition. And essentially, like, I think it's a fantastic exercise. It's a fantastic peaking exercise. It's something I've used myself, and I use it with my swimmers in various joint positions as well. So that's kind of what's going on there, if anyone's got any questions. So I know we're getting on for time, Stefan. Are we doing all right? Are you okay at your end?
I'm fine. My daughter can wait before I pick her up. You're old enough now. So this is ultimately like Bondarchuk. And I don't know why more S&Cs don't use the Bondarchuk model, because it gives it clarity, it gives it direction and guarantees a transfer of training. Because ultimately, my KPI as a fast bowling coach is that ball velocity increasing. So I don't want to arrive a week before my season with my bowlers and testing the ball speed and seeing it didn't work. You need to be testing every session. So every session I will bowl, every session I will have a speed gun. They might have motors to measure arm speed. They'll be on the 1080. So they are testing as they're training. And I followed DB Hammer as well, whoever he was, in that, the mag and the rate, duration, the dynamic sort of element to it and how you train. You should never mix a duration session, so a tempo session with a rate, a speed. Mm-hmm. You can't train those together because that causes neural confusion. Your body has no idea what it's trying to work for. So, but you can have a rate day and you can have a duration day the next day. So day one, max effort bowling, bit of trap bar deadlift work, bit of heavy sled drags with a weighted vest and then bowl a weighted ball. The next day then will be tempo bowling, 3-minute bowling non-stop, 70%, speed gun to make sure they're bowling 70%. I know then, follow the process, trust the process. I know what speeds they're going to bowl 2 months away because it's that engineering process to it, and you can go down the reverse engineering process. But I know I plot everything, with the drop-offs. If I'm going max effort today and I have to bowl tomorrow, I can only allow my bowler to drop by 1% ball velocity.
Yep.
For them to come back the next day, if I get them dropping off 6% or whatever, then they're going to need about 10 days to recover. For every percent drop-off in ball velocity requires 1.5 days of recovery. So if I want to train Monday, flat out, was the best day to train for speed, for rate, he can come back or she can come back again on Thursday. And with the rebound, we'll bowl quicker on that Thursday. But if she's not or he's not bowling quicker, based on auto-regulatory training and the initial ball, that I know he needs another day's rest. And that's how the process goes about. But it's always in the Bondarchuk model.
Yeah. No, I think that's massive as well. Understanding actually how much your athlete's got in the tank each day and then how much they're going to have in a few days' time. And obviously that's something that Carl Dietz talks about.
It's that pint of water analogy, isn't it? If you want to put something in, you better take something out. Otherwise, it's going to overflow. My programs are simple. You never get more than 3 or 4 exercise on it. But I tell you what, you're bowling, and that is one exercise. And also, it depends. I can finish on this on the neurotype as well. Mm-hmm. It's your athletes, your bowlers' sensitivity to various neurotransmitters. It dictates how you should train. It dictates their character. A type one athlete are very dopamine dominant. They look for that rush. They're very easily overtrained. If you give them too much volume, they thrive on frequency. They're the difference between a type 1A and a 1B is the amount of acetylcholine. The acetylcholine allows better usage of the stretch shortening cycle. So a hip dominant, type 1B, fascia, tendon-driven bowler, i.e. Jofra Archer, will bowl 95 miles per hour. Your type 1A, who is more about strength, loves the weights, but again, it's about intensity. They love the clusters. That was me. Love cluster training. Loves isometric. Will be knee dominant, muscle driven. Can also bowl quickly. Then you got the type twos, adrenaline dominant. They can cope with more variety. They can cope with more volume. They normally knee dominant bowlers. And then you got your serotonin dominant type threes who are not bowling fast. They need to pick something else. They can be the spin bowlers, they're not. Type three bowler will not be bowling quickly because they're the ones who they're the people pleasers. They're the ones who search for perfection in their action, and they come to you, what do you think I'm doing wrong? What's that action? What's that technique like? And I'm like, just bowl, bud. Let's worry about that some other time. So it's that understanding of how they react to neurotransmitters. Yeah. So hopefully, I know it's been a whistle stop, but I've given you how the PaceLab system works from the very moment that I identify whether they're hitting the attractors based on the dynamic systems theory. If they're not, why are they not hitting those attractors? What method do I need to use? Do I need to take it back to corrective work first? So the basic hip lock exercises or the switching exercises, or do I go into a skill stability model because I know that it's more of a hardware issue. It's more of the fact that I need to change technique by adhering to those seven ways of changing technique. And then how does that fit into my Bondarchuk model? Based on the fundamental general strength, which is a given. You have to be strong to bowl quickly. But the question is, how strong do you need to be? Mm-hmm. There's a point of diminishing return. Is there worth going from one times your body weight to 1.5? In that time, it might increase the strength deficit. You know, you never bowl with a barbell on your back. So how are you going to reduce muscle slack when you're bowling? Because when you squat, the barbell does it for you. So just small things like that.
Is that something you look at out of interest? Are you saying, okay, well, knee dominant bowlers or whatever, you need to squat around this, or is it essentially just, this is GPP, are you bowling faster? Don't really care kind of what you squat, as long as the quality is at the actual proper end of the pyramid, hence the top, are improving. Definitely.
That's the ultimate KPI. But I know that you need to trust the process. And I don't squat a lot, if I'm honest. I can't remember the last time I squatted for a bowler, because it puts you into flexion straight away, and that is the parasympathetic state, and it's not where we want to be. I want extension, so I trap bar deadlift a lot. Mm-hmm. So that's where I do, and I incline press a lot. I pull up, I do lots of pull-ups, med balls, jumps, skill stability, and bowling with weighted ball or with the exogen suit.
Well, that's, I think the trap bar in particular for me, I think it's becoming a fast favorite around the world, but it puts you in that universal athletic position for the most part, which more applicable to sports performance. The joint, hip, knee angles are very similar.
It is. It's hip, knee, and ankle, so proximal sequencing, and it's about mass specific force and the delivery system. So you work on the mass specific force, and I go on 1.5 times your body weight. That is the benchmark for me, a trap bar deadlift. Once you can do that, which is probably pretty quick, you and I know it's not hard to make someone stronger. It really isn't. That's why I don't hang my hat on that, because that is a given. You know, you can't be marketing that. But the ultimate question is by getting stronger, is that going to make you better at your sport? Mm-hmm. And that is my bag. And that is what I call the whiteboard syndrome, is where trainers actually put the lifts on the board, and how can you improve that, and look where you are, you're top of the tree. But is he bowling quicker? Is he beating men on a field? Is his pitching quicker? Is he hitting the ball further? If no, I really don't care. but if yes, awesome.
Yeah.
But how much more of that do I need to do? Exactly. I think I'm done with that now. I need to learn the art. I need to learn the skill of pitching, or, you know,
that's usually those guys that are top of the tree in the strength tests, so to speak, or the whiteboard tests. They usually suck on the field or court as well, from my experiences.
Definitely. Me too. I'm a great case study. You know, I bowled 90 miles per hour, 2001. I was, I was sort of 85 kilogram, very thin, wiry, did lots of sprinting, lots of jumping. I introduced weighted ball bowling. I increased my speed, but I wanted more. So I went from 120 bench to 150 kilogram bench as a fast bowler when a ball weighs 156 grams. It's like, what was I thinking, man? If I'd have spent that time trying to brace my front leg, there we go. That was where my speed was. That's where I would have got consistent 90.
That's where the energy leaks were and things like that. So, I mean, I'll call it there, Stefan, but I think this has been fascinating, mate. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day. Hopefully your daughter's not too disappointed that you're late in picking her up.
She'll be all right.
I think that the main thing that I think a lot of the listeners need to take away from this is you've got a system which is proven. And I think one of the biggest things that I take away from this as well is everything you do is data-driven and underpinned by science. I think that's what a lot of people need to understand, that look, it's not just this kind of wacky system or whatever people might think it is. It's a system that's underpinned by data, backed by science. And like you said, we've talked over the last few months quite a few times, and I've been constantly impressed about the things that you're putting out there. So like from my point of view, like, thank you. It's been fascinating. I've really learned a lot, and I'm sure everyone else has as well. Just to wrap it up, where can people find you if they've got questions? Like, what's the best thing to do?
I'm as you know, I'm heavily on Instagram. So it's Stefan Jones 105, and that's I don't do Twitter anymore because Twitter seems to be a platform where all S&Cs bitch about each other. So I don't go on that anymore. Instagram, Stefan Jones 105. I share a lot. Having a new website built, but I just love, what's knowledge if you don't share it? Ultimately, there's no point being the brightest man in your own brain, is there?
Absolutely, and I think you're doing a fantastic job. Like you say, you share everything, very open in your approach, and I think you're helping drive the industry forward. So thank you very much.
Pleasure. I will say though, is that I'm not saying I'm always right, and it's that having ability to listen and reevaluate, because last 2 months during lockdown, I've learned so much. So, and I learned from a lot of brighter people. And I'll finish on this. And if you're the brightest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And so thank you very much again, Stefan. Really appreciate it. And have a great day.
Pleasure, man.